It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, political turmoil in Yemen. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. While the world's attention is focused on the threat from ISIL, the violent Islamist group that calls itself the Islamic State, which has captured large swaths of Iraq and Syria, Yemen continues to battle AQAP, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, considered the most lethal and capable of al-Qaeda's affiliates, and a heavily armed Shia militia group called the Houthi movement, who currently have de facto control over the capital, Sana'a. The Houthis captured Sana'a on September 21st after weeks of anti-government protests centering on rising fuel prices. The group, which hails from Yemen's remote northern highlands, signed a power-sharing agreement with other political parties soon afterwards, a deal which was sanctioned by President Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi. Many analysts are struggling to make sense of a group which makes up about a fifth of Yemenis and which is purportedly an ally of Iran. Perhaps most startling of all is the fact that their takeover was likely made possible by an alliance with former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was once their sworn enemy. The Houthi movement sees itself as resurrecting Yemen's Arab Spring-inspired 2011 uprising against what protesters saw as the autocracy and corruption of Saleh's 33-year rule. Well, for more on the fate of Yemen and the consequences of the current political instability, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Danya Greenfield is deputy director of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. That's a Washington-based think tank, and Graham Bannerman. He's a non-resident expert at the Middle East Institute, a Washington-based think tank. He's also founder of Bannerman Associates, an international consulting firm. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Daniel Greenfield, let me begin with you. You're quite the expert on Yemen. You might want to take us back about how this movement came into Sana'a, took over. Talk about the so-called Houthi movement and who they are, what do they want, and why should we really care?
It's a lot of questions to try and unravel here, but I think, as you noted in your introduction, the Houthi movement really originated in the Northern Highlands areas, but has now managed to expand their appeal far beyond their core base centered around their leader, Abdelmalek al-Houthi. And so their entry into Sana'a and other areas throughout Yemen, I think, really need to be seen within the larger context of the political environment in Yemen and what's happened really since the 2011 uprising and the agreement that was forged in November of 2011 to move past that critical point. And this was the Gulf Cooperation Council-sponsored deal or agreement, the GCC agreement as it's referred to, which was really an elite power bargain between the primary political players and powers at that time, the political party of former President Ali Abdullah Saleh and the opposition coalition. And together they agreed to have a joint government and to move the country past that critical point of violence and tension. However, that agreement did not bring in these other actors who had also managed to make their voice heard and flex their muscles and participate in the uprising and the protests. So the Houthi movement, the Southern Hadak movement, many youth organizations and others were not actually brought into that power-sharing agreement. And this is really what has set the stage, I think, for what we're now seeing, which is the Houthi movement, very opportunistic, very savvy, took advantage and capitalized on widespread public frustration with the inability of this transition government really to deliver any concrete benefit and results for the population. Living standards have continued to deteriorate. The cost of living is still high. Jobs are still unavailable. Humanitarian crisis is widespread. The list goes on and on.
Turning to you, Graham Bannerman, to elaborate more on what Danya told us, talk a little bit about the Houthi themselves, who they are, what they represent.
I think the events in Yemen are actually part of a larger historical trend in the region and within Yemen. In my lifetime, the area has moved from people, when you ask them the question, who are you, from saying, I'm an Arab, to they now identify who are you and they name their religious community. That has changed the whole political relationship in the region. I think one of the problems President Saleh had in the past was he was a remnant of those people who answered the question, I'm an Arab. He was an Arab nationalist, but he also was a Zaydi. In Yemen, the Zaydis have been the ruling group since the Imams first took power there. The merger of the two Yemens tipped the balance of population numbers in favor of the Sunnis. Therefore, this has never been worked out, the Zaydi identity of the country with the Sunni majority. What I think the Houthis have done, when they were a rebellion against Saleh, I used to speak to some of the Saleh officials who would say, we're Zaydis, what are they doing? We're the same thing. Mm-hmm. But they were different. They were a remote group in the north, a community with tribal grievances and regional grievances. But what's made the transformation lately that's sort of surprising to at least myself and some of the other observers is that they've managed somehow to expand their identity from not being just Houthis, mm-hmm. but being representatives of the Zaydi community and Zaydi interest. They could not get into areas they've gone into unless they had a much wider support than they had 2 years ago.
Back to you, Danya Greenfield, to talk about the collapse, I guess one could say, of the so-called GCC agreement back when there was the transition from President Saleh to the current government. How are they performing now? I assume that the Gulf Cooperation Council is concerned about the turn of events, the total chaos that is engulfing the country, particularly the capital.
Let me just pick up on one point that Graham made, and then I'll answer that. I just wanted to agree with this idea that the Houthi movement has really been able to galvanize supporters far beyond its initial cohort. And this idea of a Zaydi identity and identity politics based on religion really has grown and emerged as a major force. But I think part of what's interesting also is to look at why is that this has become so compelling to Yemenis? Why is it that Houthis have been able to, again, sort of build this base of support? And I think a lot of it comes down to the inability to really provide for the constituencies that the government is meant to do. And it's because of that failure that they've been able to make that connection and to tap into this residual frustration. And the grievances, these historical grievances that he referred to, are real and tangible. And those grievances are felt not only by the Zaydis in the highlands, the Houthi movement, but among Yemenis across the board. And this is part of, I think, of what is opening the space for this to happen. And so to connect with the question that you just asked, the GCC agreement was pretty much the salient model for what has been happening over the last 2 years. It laid out a path of transition with a president who was, quote-unquote, elected. It was a single-candidate election back in February of 2012, President Hadi, and a transitional government that was a power-sharing arrangement, 50-50 between these two major political groupings, and then a path of a national dialogue that should lead to constitutional development and drafting that should then lead to a constitutional referendum and ultimately elections. That whole structure and the very essence of what the GCC agreement was based upon has completely fallen apart. And this is the new reality that I think the international community has to grapple with and has to understand. And the GCC countries, Saudi Arabia in particular, are very concerned about what's happening. Sana'a, I think, actually is relatively stable at this point. But what is happening is the Houthi movement is testing the limits. They've taken over the port of Hodeidah. Last week, they tried to take over the city of Ibb, and they were pushed out. And what has arisen this week most acutely is really the confrontations then between Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula and the Houthi movement as they battle really for control of these areas. And I think there's reason for Saudi Arabia and the United States to be concerned. The question is, what tools do we have to try and engage with this new reality, which is, again, an unraveling of the GCC agreement and really the deterioration of state institutions and the rule of law, the fact that an armed militia can enter into Sana'a and essentially the existing military forces stood down and they were able to take over. And so what does that really say about the state structure in Yemen moving forward?
Turning to you, Graham Bannerman. So what we're seeing, it appears to me, is, as Danya was saying, it's an unraveling of the GCC agreement. Basically, there's no real government in control. How do you see the current reality? And as Danya said, you know, what tools does the international community have or the GCC now to help restore stability?
The government of Yemen not being in control of all of its territory is not unique to this period of time. In fact, in my lifetime looking at Yemen, the government has always had trouble controlling all of its territories. It's been an issue for a long time. I put it in a different context. The issue really is, with all of the problems the Middle East is facing right now, this is only part of the greater picture. And the greater picture is the rise of this fundamentalist Sunni Arab identity and the Sunni Arab community having to address that. I think ISIS has brought this home to the Arabian Peninsula governments more than anything else. We, the people of the Arabian Peninsula, are now fighting for the soul of Islam. So where does Yemen fit in that? We have a problem with Shias because of the Iran issue, but we also have a problem with Al-Qaeda in Yemen. And how does that fit? If you ask me as an American and I look at Yemen, the Houthis at this point are probably doing more damage to Al-Qaeda in Yemen than our allies have done in a long time. It's quite interesting. Do we want either of them to win? That's our problem. We don't want either to win. They both are problematic to us.
Indeed. Well, question about the Houthi relationship with Iran. Do you know, Daniel Greenfield, to what extent they have a transactional or any kind of relationship, or Iranians helping to train them? Because they have a, I guess their beliefs are more Shia-oriented.
I think at this point it's pretty safe to say that there is certainly a close relationship and some level of support, both on an ideological media PR level as well as financial and technical assistance. I've heard many accounts of members of the Houthi movement going to Beirut to train with Hezbollah, of Hezbollah operatives being inside Yemen. Again, these are all just hearsay. It's very hard to get concrete information. But I think that over the past year, there has been an increase in this kind of relationship. And certainly one can see, even in the public discourse and the speeches that the main leader delivers, are very much modeled after the Hezbollah style of engaging with its population. The speeches very much echo Nasrallah and his discourse. So I think that it's not a stretch to say that there is a relationship there, and that I think they are very much watching and learning from the example of how Hezbollah managed to enter the Lebanese political space and carve out an area for itself, as well as engaging in sort of the formal political process.
Before we turn to a break, back to you, Graham Bannerman. What, in your view, is the linkage, if at all, between the Houthis and Iran? Are they the Hezbollah of Yemen?
It depends what you mean by Hezbollah. If Hezbollah became the protectors of the Shia community that was oppressed in Lebanon, and they rose to power because they protected that community, and they will ally with whomever they can to protect their community interest. If they say the Houthis are trying to protect their community, first the narrow Houthi community, now the wider Zaidi community, and they will do anything they can to do that, absolutely. And are their natural allies other groups who are seen as minorities in the region? Of course they will.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Danya Greenfield, Deputy Director of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council, that's a Washington-based think tank, and Graham Bannerman, from whom you just heard. He's a non-resident expert at the Middle East Institute, also a think tank based here in Washington. We're talking about the crisis in Yemen, the threats from both the Houthi movement and AQAP, and ramifications for regional stability. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or keep up with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Adeb Isi Oladipo from Nigeria. Well, back to you, Danya Greenfield. To look at now the rivalry between AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is still a strong force in Yemen, and the Houthis. We note that there have been major suicide attacks recently whereby Al-Qaeda militants have killed many Shiite rebels, that is the Houthi rebels. What do you make of this rivalry?
Well, I think the ability of the Houthi movement to push out into these other areas is really bringing out AQAP from some of its, I won't say hiding spaces, but the places where they found refuge and where they have built up their network. So in a sense, the organization is sort of coming out of the shadows a bit more in recent days, I think, to push back against what they see to be a threat to their own interests and to the communities in which they have found supporters. And I think we'll see more and more of that over the coming weeks and months. I should note also that while this is happening, there is a political process also underway that we didn't quite touch on, which is that the agreement that was signed between the Houthi movement and the other major political leaders in the country on September 28th set forward essentially what is a replacement for the GCC agreement, which is a process whereby a new prime minister was appointed, a new government is meant to be put in place that would be made up of technocrats or qualified individuals based on their qualifications as opposed to party affiliation. This is all contingent, of course, on the Houthis actually dismantling the protest camps that have been set up in Sana'a, as well as a ceasefire in other areas. So what's in question right now, of course, is will this agreement actually be implemented? But I will note that they have reached an agreement on a new prime minister who was Yemen's ambassador to the UN, who just departed from New York to Sana'a this past week and is now in the process of negotiation with the political factions to form a new government. So there is the potential that the political process will move forward in the midst of these ongoing sort of back and forth battles between AQAP and Houthis. And whether or not that has any impact on the Houthi movement, I think, is very much in question. There seems to be a disconnect between what's happening on the military front and what's happening in the political environment.
Turning to you, Graham Bannerman, for your take on the relationship between AQAP and the Houthis, we've seen violence, but do they have some interests that converge at all? How do you see their relationship?
They have no interests that converge at all. I mean, these are the two polar ends of the political spectrum. It's a life and death struggle. It's kind of like speaking in Syrian terms of Hezbollah and ISIS. There can be no agreement between these people because it's their basic communal identities that are so opposed to one another, it is not possible to make any agreement between them. What's interesting is in the discussions you hear only snippets up from Yemen is the reemergence of President Saleh's party as being one of the major political factors. In fact, the one potential cabinet agreement I saw discussed, they were equal to the current governing parties, and with the Houthis and the southern independent people equally representative. So all of a sudden, Saleh's people are the major force again, brought back into power. They're not the Houthis. They don't agree with the Houthis, and the Houthis don't see them as the same, but they are seen as a major political force equal to the governing party in these discussions. Now, will it work out that way in the end? None of us know because it's being negotiated, but the fact that they're in play is very interesting to me.
Well, back to you, Danya Greenfield. What about this allegation that former President Saleh is somehow behind or helping the Houthi movement come into power or at least, you know, grab some power, especially given the fact that they were arch enemies before? Can you explain that?
Let me just start by saying that conspiracy theories right now are rife in Yemen. I just read an article that laid out, I think, six different scenarios of various behind-the-scenes kind of conspiracy theories of this faction supporting that, or Saudi Arabia supporting this, and the United States supporting the Houthis to knock down AQAP.
Okay.
So
yeah.
This is an art form, I think, of looking for these kinds of stories. However, I think that there is actually somewhat widespread agreement, at least among the analysts and the people that I've spoken to in Yemen, that the Houthi movement and the militias would not have been able to enter Sana'a with such ease had they not had at least tacit, if not overt, support or acquiescence by the tribes surrounding that area. And those tribes are still thought to be loyal or at least to have some affinity with former President Saleh and his family. And so I think there is a basis to say that there is some sort of green light from former President Saleh that allowed their entry into the city with such ease, really. There is salience, I think, of that theory.
And so what's his motive for doing that?
This is where you get really into the nitty-gritty of Yemeni politics, which is an endlessly fascinating and confusing dynamic. But I mean, former President Saleh has still been in the political scene ever since he stepped down from power. He never has really exited, and he has been playing, I think, a major role behind the scenes, largely negative. And I think there's no question that he would see a gain from weakening the current government, even though President Hadi technically comes from the same party that he led, the General People's Congress, the GPC. There's certainly a rivalry and many factions within the GPC. And so this tug of war that has been going on between Saleh and President Hadi over the past 2 years has certainly been front and center. And more importantly, the transition government that Hadi has essentially been leading has been comprised predominantly of Islah-affiliated members in the ministerial positions and in the government writ large. President Hadi was able to forge this arrangement really with the support of Islah, and Saleh would definitely see benefit from weakening Islah. And this is exactly what's happened over the past couple months with the rise of the Houthis has one of the most important evolutions or developments on the political scene of what's come out of this, not only the disintegration of the GCC deal, but is really a fundamental weakening of the Islah structure and more importantly, of some of its key proponents and key leaders, both within the tribal community as well as within the military establishment. And so from Saleh's perspective, he has everything to gain from this kind of weakening, from the transition government going by the wayside, from Islah looking feckless and weak in the eyes of the public, and to reassert his control again within the GPC.
Well, if that's so, Graham Bannerman, so much for the much-hailed transition agreement in 2012 when he was ushered out, that is, former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, since he seems to be pulling a lot of strings as we speak behind the scenes. How do you see his role in this current situation, and what does he have to gain from doing this?
I think anyone who wanders into Yemeni internal politics is taking a huge risk. It is complicated, and people are playing it on many different levels that we as outsiders don't understand. But I think we make a mistake if we underestimate the continuing division between the historical northern Yemen and the south Yemen. The south Yemen was Sunni, more worldly and outreaching. The northern was the heart and soul of what it meant to be a Yemeni. The agreement was imposed on the outside, which strengthened the southern Sunnis in regard to the historical dominance of the Zaydis in the north. And I think all of the underlying elements play into here. I think the concern in Yemen is Saleh is a Zaydi. The Houthis are Zaydis. They do not want to be dominated by those southerners. The southerners are different, and I think that still plays into conversation. And adding on to that, the identity that's come to the region by we are now by our religion. That is how we're told. So therefore, if you are a Zaydi, you're not part of the mainstream of the Arabian Peninsula. The GCC people are all Sunnis. It was an agreement that strengthened the Sunnis at the expense of the Zaydis. I think this is trying to rebalance that agreement.
Turning back to you, Danya Greenfield, so it seems to me, as a result of our conversation, that there's some major underlying problems regarding this original GCC agreement, which was perhaps not as popular or as easily implemented as its progenitors would have liked. So now we are where we are. How do you see the way forward in the U.S. role, if any, particularly because the United States has been mostly concerned about the rise of AQAP, because it's the one al-Qaeda affiliate that has shown itself to be capable of launching attacks against the West. Where do things stand?
I do think that this moment offers a unique opportunity for the United States to reassess and reevaluate its policy and the way that it's been engaging in Yemeni politics and in this space. And there is somewhat of a review going on, from what I understand, interagency process within the U.S. government. But I'm not sure that it will reach the right conclusions or that it will really fundamentally look at how to do things differently. One thing that I would note is that, as you mentioned, the U.S. perspective on Yemen has been largely dominated by trying to counter the threat of AQAP and the counterterrorism sort of approach, despite efforts from people at the State Department and USAID to focus on development and the political process. There's no way to deny the fact that the counterterrorism lens has still been the dominant one, and that in that we have largely focused our efforts either utilizing drone strikes to take out specific members or investing in equipping an elite counterterrorism force. This kind of narrow perspective of looking at Yemen through this lens, I think, has really caught us off guard and really hamstrings our ability to engage. And what I hope is that the rise of the Houthi movement and their very quick gains will prompt a rethinking of looking at Yemen in a much broader context that really takes into account the various aspects, many of which Graham has delineated, of really trying to look more deeply and understand what are the roots of these conflicts and the instability, but to look at security needs in Yemen beyond just countering AQAP. Yemen lacks many basic government institutions, including security institutions and security forces that can actually provide basic and decent security services for its population. And we need to be looking far more broadly at how to address some of those systemic underlying issues and gaps if we hope to have any kind of long-term strategy and approach to dealing with threats that may be emanating from Yemeni soil.
And I have to give the last word to you, Graham Bannerman, to talk about to what extent the rise of the Houthi movement will prompt a rethinking about how to deal with Yemen, will prompt the United States perhaps to look at Yemen more broadly instead of through just a narrow counterterrorism lens. How much bandwidth do we have? Can we walk and chew gum at the same time? I mean, what are the stakes if we do not pay attention to the current situation in Yemen, if it continues to spiral out of control?
Well, Yemen is important to us. It's either of greater importance to our allies in Riyadh and Abu Dhabi. And it creates greater problems for them than it does for us. It's on their border. There are a million Yemenis who live in Saudi Arabia. And it's the worst possible situation for them. Because who are the forces that are powerful in Yemen right now? You have the Zaydis, who are related to Iran, their competitors in the region. But the other side, you have Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood, both of whom they have put on their terrorism list. And so how do you adapt a policy if you're sitting in Riyadh to this country that's vital to you and not something that's 7,000 miles away from Washington? They're the ones we have to listen to. They're the ones we have to see what they're doing, and we need to take the lead from them.
That's a very good question, and I want to follow up briefly before we close, because the way you framed it is very interesting. You have, on the one hand, AQAP, certainly not a friend to the GCC, the Saudi Arabia, or its allies. Nor, of course, are the Houthis, who seem to have an association with their arch-rival Iran. So how do you see them reconciling? Are there any opportunities for some sort of minimal rapprochement between the two power rivals, that is Iran on the one hand and Saudi Arabia? People are saying that unless there's some sort of a compromise at some level, that these sectarian conflicts, these proxy wars between Shia and Sunni will just continue.
Well, the real issue is, how do the Saudis put the rivalry between Shia and Sunni, Iran and Saudi Arabia, in the context of when they're fighting for the soul of Sunni Islam? And that's the challenge of the Islamic State and the Muslim Brotherhood. That is the battle in the region that will determine the future. Who prevails? The moderate approach to Sunni Islam in Saudi Arabia, Egypt and UAE, or the more radical approach of the Islamic State? That's the battle that really matters.
And we'll be talking about that, I'm afraid, for weeks and months to come, if not years. On that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Dania Greenfield, she's Deputy Director of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council, and Graham Bannerman, non-resident expert at the Middle East Institute and founder of Bannerman Associates. Thanks so much to both of you for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wojtek Zorniak. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.